The first verse to kind of give the setting. Joseph has been thrown in prison and interprets a dream. And then we have verse 1, chapter 41. After 2 whole years, and Joseph, of course, is waiting in prison, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing by the Nile, and we have then his dream. And skipping down to verse 9, then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, "I remember my offenses today, when Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me and the chief baker in custody in the house of the captain of the guard. We dreamed on the same night, he and I, each having a dream with its own interpretation. A young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. When we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving us an interpretation to each man according to his dream. And as he interpreted to us, so it came about. I was restored to my office, and the baker was hanged." Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came up in before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I've had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." Joseph answered Pharaoh, "It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer." And then going down to verse 38. And Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom the Spirit is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I've set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and clothed him in the clothes of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. And they made him ride in his second chariot. And they called out before him, "Bow the knee." Thus he set him over the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zarephath-Panai, and he gave him in marriage Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. During the 7 plentiful years, the earth produced abundantly. And he gathered up all the food of these 7 years, which occurred in the land of Egypt, and put the food in the cities. He put in every city the food from the fields around it. And Joseph stored up the grain in great abundance, like the sand of the sea, until he ceased to measure, for it could not be measured. Before the year of famine came, 2 sons were born to Joseph. Asenath, the wife of Potipharah, wife of On, the priest of On, bore them to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, "God has made me forget all my hardship in all my father's house." And the name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. The 7 years of plenty that occurred in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. There was famine in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. When all the land of Egypt was famished, The people cried out to Pharaoh for bread. Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, "Go to Joseph. What he says to you, do." So when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. For the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain, because the famine was severe over all the earth. And then have the account of Joseph's brothers coming down, and eventually he says to his brothers, "God has sent me here before you." I want us to think this morning about the sovereignty of God. Now, our usual remote on the TV sort of sticks and doesn't work very well. And I find myself, as I want to change channels, just using the down button to go channel by channel down to get to a particular station. The danger of doing that is, as you're going down, you might see something. And the other day, I saw one of the TV evangelists, so to speak, on there. And I couldn't help but knowing that this was my sermon, listening to him, because he started in by saying, "This preacher told me, you know, to believe in the sovereignty of God." But he's obviously wrong. And he went on for his proof that God isn't sovereign, God is in control of all things. Well, isn't that cruel? What do you say to a woman who's been raped if God's in control of all things? And that was his proof. That's a hard issue to deal with. And yet, if God isn't sovereign, I think the issue becomes harder. Because if he isn't, then is that just an act over which God has no control? That God is powerless in this universe? And there are those who set forth that idea. The book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, basically says that, and says that, well, you know, God can't control things, and we just really need to forgive God for not being powerful enough to control everything. So that's one solution to the problem. And the other is even more monstrous, to think that God has control, but he somehow favors, he somehow wants it to happen. And that's even more monstrous to think about. But the standard answer has been that God is indeed sovereign. God permits evil. And sometimes we don't understand the reasons why he does it, but he is governing his creatures for his glory. And we may not understand why someone dies in a car accident, or why a woman is raped, or why someone is struck with a deadly disease, or war breaks out. But we need to understand that God is indeed control. It really is a consistent message that we find throughout Scripture. And the 12th century theologian John of Salisbury wrote in 1159, "We're like dwarfs standing on the shoulders of giants. We see more, and the things that are more distant than they did." We're talking about earlier theologians. "Not because our sight is superior, or because we're taller than they, but because they raise us up, and by their great stature, add to ours." And what he was talking about is that as we make theological advances, as we understand more, it's because of those who've gone on before. As the church developed, the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, and some of the other things, we were able to understand certain truths better and to build upon them. And so we can come to systematic statements about the nature of God, the nature about Jesus Christ as salvation. And just like a human pyramid builds row on row and gets higher and higher, so too as we build on those truths. We build spiritually from previous generations. And that's true in all sorts of areas. You know, think about chemists. What do? They take what has been established in chemistry and try to go on and find something new. Someone building a house, a carpenter, learns the tricks of the trade so that they can build a house. A young girl learning how to cook. She doesn't usually go into the kitchen and start experimenting. She's taught and learns from her mother. An athlete goes to a coach to learn. How foolish it would be in the spiritual realm to think we need to start over. But there are those who say, no creed but Christ, no book but the Bible, no name but the divine, as if that was something that's good. And yet ignores the wisdom of previous generations who studied the Scriptures diligently, who had the Holy Spirit indwelling them and guiding them. And thus, we are a confessional church. There are things that the church has studied and we hold to. And so as we think about the sovereignty of God, where do we begin? Well, we can look at the Westminster Larger Catechism, question number 18. What are God's works of providence? God's works of providence are the most holy, wise, and powerful, preserving and governing all His creatures, ordering them and all their actions to His own glory. Essentially, that verse is saying God is sovereign. God is in control of what goes on for all of His creatures. They're not acting independent of His will. And one of the places that it is used in support of it is Genesis 45:7. We didn't read that verse, but it's the culmination of this passage where Joseph talks to his brothers and he says, God sent me before you. It's not you who sent me down to Egypt, but God who did it. He recognized God was sovereignly controlling what had happened. God was the one who placed him in Egypt and had a purpose for him being there. At the time of being sold into captivity as a slave, you could wonder why. But as he looks back, he can see God sovereignly at work. Well, the first point is we can see that God is in sovereign control over the natural realm. God was the one who brought on 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine. Now, the Nile, as it went through Egypt, was the lifeblood for the growing of crops. Every spring, it would bring down fresh rain and rainwaters and new soil that would be flooding Egypt. And they would count on it. And the people would irrigate. And the crops would grow. And outside where they could irrigate, there would be desert. But along the Nile, there would be these fantastic crops. And so, when there's a prediction that there's going to be 7 years of famine, it's saying upstream there's going to be a drought. For 7 years at the source of the Nile, there's not going to be any rain. Now that would have been very unusual. For that to happen 1 year would have been unusual. For that to happen year after year for 7 years would have been exceedingly unusual. And how could Joseph say that is what's going to happen? Well, it's only as God is in control of the natural realm. As God controls the weather, as God controls the rain or the lack of rain, then can Joseph confidently say that there is going to be drought? Because God's in control of the natural realm. And we might just note in passing that this is an additional proof of the deity of Jesus Christ. Because we see that same power being manifested in Jesus Christ. Think about His control of the natural realm, of calming the sea, of walking on the water, of telling the apostles where to put down their net to catch a great catch of fish. Only God, only someone who is God, has that kind of control. And all we have to think back is Katrina to realize how little control we have over the weather. We can try to see clouds and do some other things, but ultimately those storms can wreak havoc. There can be great drought on the land. Whatever God decides. Second point is we can see God's sovereign control over Pharaoh and over Egypt. First, God causes Pharaoh to have a dream, verse 1. That's a very distressing and mysterious dream. It has elements, we didn't read through it, but you have a sense of what it was, of everyday life, of cattle and ears of corn, things that they would have had. But there's things that were completely abnormal. Thin cattle eating fat cattle, and withered ears of corn and swallowing up fat ones. What was God doing? God was using this to get Pharaoh's attention in order that he could accomplish his purposes. You know, like other times in the Old Testament, especially in the early parts of Genesis, this dream was not an ordinary dream, but was given to reveal something of the purpose of God. And God often used dreams in the Old Testament to contact those who didn't have a relationship with Him. Pharaoh would have been a pagan, would have been an idolater, and so if you had gone to him and talked to him about God, he would have had all these wrong ideas about God in his mind. And so God uses this dream to get his attention. He trusted in astrologers and magicians. But they couldn't help. They couldn't interpret. He was a complete loss to understand what was going on. And keep in mind, at this point, Pharaoh is the most powerful man in the world. The most important nation, the most powerful and nation on the earth. And as a ruler of that nation, anything he wanted, he could get, he could just command it, they would bring it to him. But here is something that he can't control. Something which is beyond him. Something which would have unnerved him. He had no insight. He was powerless to understand the meaning of this dream that he knew to be significant. What did it mean for him? What did it mean for his kingdom? Well, second, or B, as you look at Joseph's explanation, maybe the most crucial thing is how he points Pharaoh to his God. Verse 16, Pharaoh, as Joseph goes to Pharaoh, Joseph says, "It's not in me." He's not claiming any power for himself. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. And in verse 25, God has told Pharaoh what he's about to do. In verse 28, he repeats it. In verse 32, he says, it means that this matter is determined by God. And God will quickly bring it about. And then in those verses, Pharaoh understands and says, the God of Joseph. He understands that who is the one who is controlling the situation. It's not Pharaoh. It's not his magicians. It's not his gods. But the God of Joseph who is controlling Egypt. And whatever ideas he may have had about God, who God was. He didn't miss that emphasis that Joseph made, that it was God who was in control. God who was directing history. One who could use as a force of nature, one way or another, to cause prosperity or to cause famine. Today, there's sometimes bandied about who is in control of the world. And you hear different answers. The politicians, the multinational corporations, the military, the media, the business leaders, big oil, all sorts of ideas. But ultimately, as Christians, we need to understand that God is in control. He's preserving and governing all their actions, all our actions. Third point is that we can see God's sovereign control over Joseph's life. Some people think in terms of God's control, yes, over world wars and that sort of thing, but not in the small details. Well, that's not true, because even a sparrow doesn't fall to the ground without God. But here we can see a person's life. Joseph. His brothers meant what they did for his harm, to get rid of him. But God was using it to prepare him for the future. When the moment came, God had prepared Joseph to speak to Pharaoh. And think how wonderful he'd been preparing. Even that 2 years that he spent in prison, because the cupbearer was forgetful, was being used to cause him to trust God, to rely upon God and not man, to know that his salvation was not in the cupbearer, was not in Pharaoh, but was in his God. And so Joseph knew what it meant to be a servant of the Most High God. He was being led into Pharaoh, and you have a sense of the majesty. He had to be cleaned up. He didn't look proper enough to go in. And it'd be a very lavish scene. And it'd be easy to be overwhelmed by the lavishness of Pharaoh's court, of the gold and the robes and everything else that's there. But he's not overwhelmed with that. He is relaying God's message to Pharaoh. And how had God prepared Joseph? Well, first of all, by teaching him to rely upon him. As you look down at verses 51 and 52, the names of his sons. Those names are Hebrew names. Now, Joseph is given an Egyptian name that I mispronounced. It's hard to pronounce. But he gives his sons Hebrew names. And he attributes his success and his joy to God. And those names symbolize it. And think how remarkable that would be as he would look at his life being sold into slavery, a false accusation against him by Potiphar's wife, being thrown into prison, of looking at a time when he might get out and then having to wait 2 more years. But he remained true to God and did not abandon his faith. And he realizes that God has helped him each step of the way. Second thing is God gave him that ability to interpret dreams. Now, Joseph rightly insists that it's upon God to reveal the meaning of the dreams, and does so. But he gives and chooses to give to Joseph that ability. Not once, but twice. the first time was really the proving ground when he had tells about the cupbearer and the baker and what's going to happen to them. It becomes foundational that the Pharaoh can know because he's already showed that he can rightly interpret. And so he can know when he hears this interpretation of his dream that this man can be trusted. That God indeed does reveal to him the meaning of dreams. That it's his God that's ultimately controlling situations and events. Third thing, that God was developing in Joseph managerial skills. In terms of Potiphar's household, you know, he rose to leadership. You look in chapter 39, verse 3. How he becomes the second most powerful person in that household, just behind Potiphar, until his wife falsely accuses him in jail. Again, in chapter 39, verse 22, he rises to the top. He's overseeing the workings of that jail, and thus, in the verses that we read, he becomes number two again. Now it's over the whole land. He's put in charge of preparing for the famine and then of giving out the food when it's needed. What was God's purposes in all this? Well, first, to get his servant Joseph out of prison to the spot of being number two in the land of Egypt. Think how extraordinary it was, that position that he held. The power and influence that he had for good, for God's people, who were only 70 in number at this point. But they were able to be preserved and to prosper. Think what it would be like in China or another land if the number two person in that country were a Christian. We think, well, that couldn't happen. Well, God can do it. He did it here. He did it later with Daniel, raising men to powers or positions of power and influence. The second thing God is doing is taking care of the people. And that includes the Egyptians. They're spared the great severity of the famine because of this dream. And so God graciously is protecting. And in that then, God's people, Jacob's family, are preserved and increase. And so he's preserving society, but he's also preserving his chosen ones. And in that, God is thirdly bringing his chosen people to a place where they can become a mighty nation. They go down to Egypt, 70 persons. They come out several million strong and in unity. And what's interesting is they don't intermarry. A small group like that could easily intermarry and be lost in the larger group. Could be swallowed up, but they aren't. And so they are an identifiable group that go forth and are able to conquer the promised land. Now a large nation. And as they conquer that land, and as they live in it, there's going to come the Messiah, that Redeemer who's going to redeem his people. And the fourth reason for doing this is so that God can glorify himself. This Pharaoh who interacted with Joseph saw the glory of God. A later one at the time of Moses would see the glory of God in a different way. That glory being shown in judgment. But in both cases, God was glorifying himself. and can use someone seemingly insignificant. This foreign-born slave, thrown into prison, wasting away in prison, who exalted to a position of leadership. Later on, a runaway murderer who tends sheep for 40 years and is sent back to lead out a people. And ultimately, we think of a child born in an insignificant village of poor parents who are forced by a census to go there. Through that child, he is glorified. All these events that seemingly you could look at random and wonder what's going on when they're taking place. Of Joseph being betrayed by his brothers, of being sold into slavery, of being falsely accused, of being thrown into prison, of languishing in prison, are to prepare him in the providence of God for what was going to take place. It was being reunited with the family and then growing and prospering. In all this, leading to the first coming of the Messiah, God was in control. God knew what he was going to do. And at the right time, he would bring the Messiah into the world. And likewise, as we think of what's going on now in history, that God is in sovereign control. He is governing all his creatures. And what's history headed toward? As God controls it, it's headed toward the second coming of Christ. And God has to be in control for that to happen, according to his plan and his timing. For the application, as you realize that God is in sovereign control over all events, is to trust him. We may not always know why. There's some things that we'll never know in this life. Why did this certain tragedy happen? Why did things turn out? Why didn't we get that job promotion? Why did a certain person get elected to office, not somebody else? There are many things we may not understand in this life. But what we can know is that God's purposes are being sovereignly carried out. Purposes that are ultimately for the good of his people. And even if we can't see the purpose, God knows what he's doing and why. And we can trust him. Because he is in control. He is not helpless or hapless in the face of history. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we do praise you that you are in control of all things. Not in such a way that you're the author of evil, but yet even when evil things happen, when tragedy strikes, when the evil are allowed to flourish, it's not apart from your will, it's not apart from accomplishing of your purposes. It's not apart from what you're going to do for your people. We give thanks for that and the fact that we can rely upon that and teach us each day how to rely upon these things that are out of our control. To know that they're under your control and that you're working to accomplish your purposes. Give us that trust that looks to you. That's willing to bow down sometimes before your wisdom that we can't understand. As we know you're accomplishing your purposes, which are good, exceedingly good for your people. Turn please to Psalm 67.